out on my way to Harlem. Ellington, you don't live around here. He moved away one day, so they say, from Harlem. I can hear his echo still. Nah, 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 you can't keep me away from where I was born. I was baptized by my daddy's horn. He moved away one day from his way here in Harlem. I know that Marvin Gaye used to play right here. Somebody say, you can't keep me away from where I was born.
Songwriter, actor, and one-time restaurant cook, Gregory Porter, with On My Way to Harlem. This is from his 2012 album, Be Good. In 2014, he won the Grammy Award for Best Jazz Vocal Album for Liquid Spirit, and again last year for his album, Take Me to the Alley. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and Harlem is going to figure into our discussions today as we introduce you to one of the greatest minds in the United States, one of the greatest minds, and yet so little is known of him. And our guest will do the honors. We have a wonderful guest today. A mere shadow of its past, Harlem today gives almost no hint that it was the epicenter of the black world. Segregationist white supremacist laws and policies rigidly controlled life in America, especially in its non-white communities. And the system controlled life in America, especially in these communities. It assumed that it had and will continue to have permanently the upper hand, but it vastly underestimated the enduring impact of the black church and radical black political thought. Longtime union activist and independent scholar Dr. Jeffrey Perry is with us today to present a portrait of Hubert Harrison, the father of Harlem radicalism, whose political philosophies were far ahead of their time. Harrison influenced the thinking of many black leaders of the day and many who would follow, both within the United States and the African diaspora. And yet, he's not widely known. Perry preserved and inventoried the Hubert H. Harrison papers, now at Columbia University's Rare Book and Manuscript Library, and is the editor of A Hubert Harrison Reader, published by Wesleyan University Press in 2001, and Harrison's When Africa Awakes, the inside story of the stirrings and striving of the new Negro in the Western world. And he is the author of Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. Jeff Perry currently is working on volume 2 of the Hubert Harrison biography. And that's just a little bit of what you've been doing, Jeff. And thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Utrice, and thank you so very much for having me on your show. Appreciate it.
Oh, not at all. I should also mention that Jeff Perry singularly just lifted my spirits and certainly my knowledge of a central question in American political thought, social and political thought, and that was through publishing or getting published, editing and getting ready for publishing, Theodore Allen's book, The Invention of the White Race. I always say to listeners, Jeff, if you have a library or you're starting one, that book has got to be on the shelf.
Well, I agree.
It's an extraordinary book.
Harrison and Allen are two of the most important thinkers on race and class in the 20th century. I'm firmly convinced of that. And I think increasingly people are going to come to understand that.
Well, let's start with this introduction. Tell us who Hubert Harrison was and why he's such a central figure in the evolution of radical political thought in the United States.
Great, I will. I just want to mention before beginning, for people who want more information on Harrison, there is tons of information, audio, video, articles, at my webpage, www.jeffreybperry.net, so they can take a look there. But Harrison, Hubert Harrison, was born in 1883 and he dies in 1927. So he only lives 44 years. But he was a brilliant intellectual, writer, speaker, book reviewer, theater reviewer, and activist. He was a race and class conscious radical internationalist. He is described as the father of Harlem radicalism by A. Philip Randolph and others. And I've argued in all my works that he's a key link in the struggle, the civil rights, black liberation struggles, as typified in the wings of, related to Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. We'll get into that. And I believe he'll continue to grow in importance. So I want to, if I may, I'd like to describe him first as an intellectual in an overview, then as a radical activist in an overview, and then I'd like to go through a little of his life. And if you want to change that format, we can change it at any point. If you want to bring in questions and answers or leave them for the end or tomorrow, however you want to handle it. But discussing Harrison as an intellectual first, Joel A. Rogers, Jamaica-born Joel A. Rogers, a Pullman porter and a great lay historian, writes, and he, in his book, World's Great Men of Color, which I believe has gone through 7 or 8 reprint editions, that Hubert Harrison was perhaps the foremost Afro-American intellect of his time. And that's amidst chapters on Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, William Monroe Trotter, Marcus Garvey. So he's truly considered a giant by Rogers. As an intellectual, I'm going to get into this again, but Harrison's born in St. Croix, so he's coming from the Virgin Islands. He's coming from the Caribbean, and that's very important in understanding his whole growth and development. But when he first comes to the U.S., to New York in 1900, he's a 17-year-old orphan, and he starts going to high school at night while working multiple jobs. And one of the New York papers, the New York World, runs a headline, "Genius found in West Indian student." Although he's only going to school at night, he gets citywide honors in a couple subjects, and they've never seen anybody like this. He spoke or read to varying degrees 6 languages. He is an autodidact, essentially. He's self-taught. He never goes to college a day in his life. We see this later in Malcolm, this brilliance. We see it in others, right? He read voraciously, and I have accounts of him reading multiple books in a day. And I, at first I said, wait a minute, is this possible? But as I went through his the books in his collection, his personal collection, and his diary, I saw how he knew how to pick up a book and look at it and then focus, hone in on what he thought was important and interact with that. So he really was able to handle the materials in depth where he felt it was needed, but with great breadth also. As an orator, he was the pioneering soapbox orator in Harlem. And this is in a period pre-TV and radio when getting out there on the streets and talking to the people was a principal means of mass communication. And he pioneered that tradition, which gets picked up later on by Philip Randolph, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm, and many others later on. But Harrison's the real pioneer. And he would speak on history, science, politics, religion, education, literature, theater, evolution, race and class. I've now located, I think my count is up to over 700 talks that he gave in his short life. This is incredible. He's a man who lives in poverty. As an intellectual, he also was a prolific writer. Although he dies young at 44, I've located over 700 articles that he's written. I'll get into where he was writing them and who was publishing them in a second. He completed two books, The Negro and the Nation, in 1917, and the one you mentioned previously, When Africa Wakes, the inside story of the new Negro in the Western world. As a journalist and editor, he edited The Masses, which was the leading left, he was one of the editors of The Masses, the leading left literary publication in the early teens. He edited around 1911. He edits The Voice, which is recognized as the first newspaper of the new Negro movement in 1917. Please note these dates because we're going to come back to them because people hear about the new Negro. They associate it with Alain Locke, 1925. This is Harrison in 1917, right? And it's a self-proclaimed journal of the new Negro movement, right? In 1919, he edits a publication called The New Negro, which is intended as an organ of the international consciousness of the Negro, of the darker races, especially the Negro race. And then, perhaps most importantly, in 1920, he becomes the principal managing, the principal editor of Marcus Garvey's Negro World when it sweeps the globe, and he continues to function as editor up until 1922. And finally, in his last year, before his death, he is editing a publication called The Voice of the Negro, which is the publication of his final effort, the International Colored Unity League. Again, you see ties here, similar in some ways to Malcolm with his organization of Afro-American Unity towards the end of his life, right? As a critic, Harrison receives extraordinary praise from many writers. Eugene O'Neill, who wins the Pulitzer Prize, I guess, in literature, writes that after reading one of Harrison's reviews of The Emperor Jones, writes, "You have a role in any theater I'll be involved with." He thought it was an extraordinary review. And to this day, we have members of the National Book Critics Circle, their executive board, citing quotes from Harrison on their webpage on how to review books. He also describes himself as the first regular book reviewer in Negro newspaperdom. And I've located probably about 70 book reviews that he's done. But he's not taught in so many of these classes, you know, on literary criticism, book reviewing, and the like. Going on, if I may, as an intellectual, he was a pioneer black activist in the socialist movement, in the free thought movement, which was thought unfettered by religious dogma, in the birth control movement, pioneering black activists, particularly in the birth control movement, and, of course, in the New Negro movement, which he founds the first organization and first newspaper of the militant New Negro movement. He is also a promoter and aide to black writers and artists. And it's people like Claude McKay and Charles Gilpin, the actor, Augusta Savage, sculptress, and Sol Plaat from South Africa, and many, many more. He was a featured lecturer and the only black lecturer for the New York City Board of Education in the 1920s when he was speaking at night, because that's when people had a chance to go get some classes in or go get some education. It was free education put forth by the Board of Education. And he was a great bibliophile and library popularizer. He collected books. He sold them. He encouraged people to read all the time. And he was a founding officer of the committee on that set up the Division of Negro Literature, History, and Prints, which grew into the 135th Street branch of the New York branch of the Public Library's Schomburg Center, right? So he's kind of a founding officer of what became the Schomburg Center. So that's an overview of Harrison as an intellectual, as a radical. When he is called, as you've mentioned and I've mentioned, the father of Harlem radicalism by Randolph and others. And as you pointed out earlier also, this is in a period when Harlem is considered the center of radical black thought and an international Negro Mecca. People were coming from down south, from the Caribbean, from elsewhere in the world, Africa, Europe possibly, to come, because Harlem, in a sense, was where it was at in terms of black thought and black thinking and in many areas. And Randolph describes him as the father of Harlem radicalism. Hubert Harrison is the only person in United States history to play leading signal roles in the largest class radical and the largest race radical movements of his era. He was a leading black activist and theoretician in the Socialist Party around 1912 during its heyday. And he would be speaking oftentimes as many as 23 times a week. I'll talk about this in a second. I just want to finish this overview. And he's also the a seminal influence and a major influence in race radicalism, because he's the founder of the first organization, the Liberty League, his own organization, and the first newspaper, The Voice of the New Negro Movement, the militant New Negro Movement, and editor of Garvey's Negro World. And a leading Garvey scholar, Robert A. Hill, points out correctly that the Garvey movement was a component part of the New Negro Movement. So Harrison's playing a leading role in both the class radical and the race radical movements. Just highlighting this New Negro, his role in the New Negro Movement, again, in the overview, he founds the first organization and the first newspaper in 1917. That's The Voice and the Liberty League. In 1919, he edits The New Negro, a monthly magazine of a different sort, described as an organ of the international consciousness of the darker races, especially the Negro race. And in 1920, he writes When Africa Awakes, and people should pay attention to that subtitle. It is the inside story of the stirrings and strivings of the new Negro in the Western world. And even that one in 1920 is 5 years before Alain Locke writes The New Negro. So that, in an overview, is Harrison. So what I've argued is he is the major radical influence, and I cite the documents. And my biography in Volume 1, it's a very large biography. It's over 600 pages with many notes and footnotes and pictures. And I encourage people to try and get this. If they can't purchase it, please try and get your library to get it. If it doesn't have it, read it from the library. But he is the major radical influence on Randolph by Randolph's own recognition, and he is the major radical influence on Marcus Garvey, as attested to by quite a number of their contemporaries. And when we take those lines of descent down, if you will, we go to Martin, who marches with Randolph at his side in the March on Washington, and Malcolm, whose mother was a reporter for the Negro World, the same paper that Harrison had been editor of and whose father was a Garveyite preacher. So I kind of sum this much of this up in the notion that Harrison profoundly influenced a generation of new Negro militants and common people. He always spoke affectionately of the common people. That's why I appreciated your little introduction to him. He lived on the most densely populated block in Harlem for his last years and stayed in Harlem. And he was also an important radical internationalist. He's extremely knowledgeable on Africa, Asia, the Mideast, the Caribbean, and Richard B. Moore from Barbados originally writes, Harrison was above all the militant black socialist in his steady emphasis on the liberation of the oppressed African and colonial peoples. Winston James, an outstanding historian, explains that Harrison had confidence in and humility before the peoples and cultures of Africa, and his knowledge on this was encyclopedic. He proudly identified with the African continuities in St. Croix, where he came from. And for Harrison, Africa was primarily a teacher, not a primitive, unschooled child in need of civilization. There's much more to that concept, which maybe we'll unfold later on. But Harrison himself writes in his last years, although I am not satisfied with American conditions as they are now, I realize I would not have been satisfied anywhere else. In China, I would be fighting against foreign domination. In Egypt, India, South Africa, or West Africa, I would be fighting against the British oligarchs. In Jamaica, against the sinister repression of black people practiced by both blacks and mulattoes. And in the Dutch, French, or American West Indies, against crackerism, stupidity, or cowardice. Hodge Kiernan, who comes from Montserrat, another wonderful journalist of that era, writes that Harrison lived with and amongst his people, and his radicalization crystallized the radicalism of the new Negro in the New York area and elsewhere. So in summing up this overview, Harrison is race conscious, he's class conscious, he's scientific, he's an internationalist, he emphasizes the common people. He's a proponent and practitioner of a mass approach. In his day, the two principal means of reaching the masses was soapbox oratory and newspapers. He's a big proponent of direct action, which I will speak about, but that's also rooted in his Caribbean St. Croix years. He understands the interrelation of literature and the arts. He's anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist. He's scientific. He challenges white supremacy. He understands it's central to capitalist rule. When he dies in 1927, he has a massive Harlem funeral. And there are a number of pallbearers, very important, longtime Harlem activists, and a number of wonderful eulogies. But a key eulogy was delivered by Arthur Schomburg. And Schomburg, who knew how important Harrison was in his day, I think accurately stated that Hubert Harrison was ahead of his time. And I think this is true and important for us to consider because he was, so he has much to offer us today. Now, I can take a little break here if you want, if you have any questions, or I can highlight in brief why he's not better known, or I can get into aspects of his life. How would you think would be best to proceed?
I think you ought to keep going.
Okay. All right. So that's an overview.
And I would insert this as well so that you are relieved of any pressure to hurry this up. If we go at your pace, if more time is needed, more time will be provided. So just keep going.
Okay.
We are in your class, Professor.
I mean, no, Professor, independent scholar. like Harrison and Allen. Okay, in brief, before we get into his life, I'm just going to describe and explain a little bit, because one of the first questions people often ask is, well, gee, if he's so important, why isn't he better known? And I've written some on this, but I will be writing much more, and I don't want to get mean-spirited, but I'm going to give an example or two, so we'll talk. First, Harrison is not better known because he's poor. He lived in poverty his whole life. He's working class. He is black. He is very black, you know, so that is twofold aspect of that. He is foreign born. He's from the Caribbean. He's all those categories are categories that are seriously underrepresented in U.S. history, right? All those categories. And he certainly falls into those categories. In addition, he is a radical in the most powerful country in the world, and he's a radical on class, race, and religion. And J.A. Rogers pays particular attention to his radicalism and the next thing I'm going to mention. He is a forthright critic. He is not mean-spirited, but he will speak truth to power, if you will. He will speak and raise his objections where he thinks it's necessary, and not in a mean-spirited way, but to push the struggle forward. And that comes, and I'll speak about this, from his early intellectual growth in black intellectual circles in New York. In particular, comes from that. He has no long-lasting organizational ties. Du Bois towards the end, he was with the NAACP for many years, and then in later years, the CP, Communist Party, picks up his memory. Garvey has the Garvey movement for all those years. But Harrison has no long-lasting organizational ties, so he has no organization that keeps his memory alive. He dies young at 44, but he wasn't martyred like Malcolm and Martin, right? So it's not that aspect of it. But then another issue, which I really, when I finish Volume 2, I want to write a lot more about, but it's got to do with how history is written and reviewed in this country and elsewhere. But it's a very serious issue because we should know more about Harrison. I'll point out first, before I get into that, I just want to mention, in terms of his speaking his mind, Rogers explains that much of the enmity against Harrison was incurred by his devastating candor. He spoke out freely what he thought, and more often than not, it was with such annihilating sarcasm and wit that those whom he attacked never forgave him. Before he began, he collected the evidence, but there was, however, no personal malice in Harrison's shafts, and he was willing to shake hands with the opponent as soon as he had descended from the platform and was surprised and hurt that others were not. He came out of an intellectual tradition where you could have differences and then, you know, go on and try and move things forward the next day, that evening, whatever. Amongst the people he criticized in his life, both leaders and organizations, amongst black leaders, he openly criticized Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, Chandler Owen, Charles W. Anderson, who's a leading black Republican, and that was in a period when much of the black community, African-American community, was tied to the Republican Party. Douglas had said the Republican Party is the ship, all else is the sea, going back to Lincoln. There were many ties here. Now it's the Democratic Party, for various reasons. He criticized many left labor and literary figures, including NAACP leaders, Mary White Ovington, Oswald Garrison Villard, and Joel E. Spingarn, Socialist Party leaders Ernest Unterman, Kate Richardson O'Hare, labor leaders such as Samuel Gompers, Communist Party leaders such as William Z. Foster, and literary figures such as Carl Van Vechten. He also criticized organizations such as the American Federation of Labor, the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, the Urban League, the NAACP, the Amsterdam News, the New Review, and the Nation. So he, you know, over the years, he would speak and put forth his differences and disagreements. Now, when I talk about he's not better known because of how history is written, I have a note in my recent book on Harrison, which I edited, the When Africa Awakes book, and in it, I write basically along these lines. Though Harrison's contributions to the New Negro Movement are well documented, They have often been ignored or presented in a manner that removed from view his seminal role. For example, Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr. makes no mention of Harrison in his major article, The Trope of the New Negro and the Reconstruction of the Black, and that was published in 1988. And this was Gates' major article before he winds up becoming the head of the Du Bois Institute up at Harvard, right? Gates also does not mention Harrison in his book written in 2011, which aims to be which seeks to look at the full sweep of African American history. That book, Life Upon These Shores, Looking at African American History, 1513 to 2008, does not mention Harrison at all. Now, in a book that Gates co-edits with Jean Andrew Jarrett, which aims to be the canonical text, because Gates is very much into canonical texts, for study of the New Negro Movement. The book is entitled The New Negro, Readings on Race, Representation, and African American Culture, 1892 to 1938. The introduction mentions Harrison briefly and does not discuss the significance of his pioneering 1917-1919 contributions to the New Negro Movement. It puts under a 1920 heading two 1917 articles, so he's moving them back, right? I cite what the articles are. The book offers no dates for another 1917 article. I cite what it is again. And it incorrectly identifies a 1920 article as being from 1925. It also implies that W.E.B. Du Bois' political warrior mentality related to World War I resonated with Harrison, when in fact, Harrison was arguably the leading critic of Du Bois during the war because of Du Bois' close ranks and forget our special grievance positions in 1918 Crisis magazine, and because Du Bois applied for a captaincy in military intelligence, that branch of the government that monitored the black and radical communities. So there you get a little taste of, I mean, Harrison speaks on all of this stuff, and how he's portrayed is not accurately and not the way he should be portrayed, I don't think. So, moving on, we'll give a little history of Harrison's life and see how we're doing. He's born in St. Croix, Danish West Indies, 1883. St. Croix is a sugar-producing economy, capitalist agriculture, and slavery. It's a colony of Denmark. It has a rich history of African customs, public gardens, and the like. The color line is drawn different in St. Croix than in the southern United States. I'm going to talk about this in a second. And it's similarly different in elsewhere in the Anglo-Caribbean, particularly Barbados and Jamaica. St. Croix has a history of direct action, mass struggle, a rich history. And in St. Croix, Harrison has benefits from a family life that includes interaction with immigrants and the immigrant experience. His mom is an immigrant from Barbados. His father had been his biological father had been born enslaved in St. Croix. When I talk about the color line being drawn differently in St. Croix than in the U.S., and I'm going fast, but I go into this in great depth in the books and explain and go into his, you know, all these things with details, footnoting. In St. Croix, for social control reasons, and this is very important for my work with Alan, too, because Alan stresses the centrality of the social control issue in terms of the white race and white supremacy. And in St. Croix, for social control reasons, there was a policy of promotion, not strict proscription, for a significant sector of the African-descended population. There was no formal segregation, there was no history of lynch law, and white supremacy was not as virulent or as organized as in the U.S. A significant part of that, the reason for that, is in St. Croix, the demographics of the population around the time when Harrison's born and growing up is the population was 5% European, 15% colored of mixed European and African ancestry, and 80% of the population was black, essentially plantation laborers. So the greatly outnumbered European ruling elite, for social control reasons, sought to implement a policy of promotion of the sector of the African descended population, the quote, coloreds, right? So how did this manifest itself? In St. Croix, there was a policy of promotion and land holding for men of color, right? Free coloreds in the days of slavery served in the militia, which was an instrument of social control. And back in 1834, free coloreds were extended an edict of full equality. That is a law which at least nominally granted full equality between free coloreds and Europeans. By contrast, in the U.S., going back in the days of slavery, the general policy, and later, but the days of slavery, by contrast, the general policy was one of severe racial proscriptions for African Americans. Slave patrols were lily white, no promotion of free coloreds into the slave patrol. And Negroes, as codified in the Dred Scott decision of 1856-57, had no rights that a white was bound to respect. There was no edict of full equality. So that's part of the environment that Harrison grows up in. While he's in St. Croix, he's living in poverty, but he does get the chance to pursue. He's hungry for learning, and he's able to access books in a church library down there, and he's able to serve as an underteacher in local schools. These are opportunities that, in general, I mean, down south, there were so many traditional and longstanding prohibitions against black reading and education of black youth. So this is something that Harrison was able to, you know, utilize in his St. Croix experience. St. Croix also had a rich history of struggle. In 1848, there was an emancipation victory led by enslaved people, and a fellow named Budo was considered the leader. And that's enslaved-led emancipation victory in the Caribbean. And in 1878, there was a great struggle led by Queen Mary Thomas. The main road east-west in St. Croix is named after her to this day. And it was followed by a struggle in that was called the Great Fireburn, and it's followed by a general strike of 1879. And then Harrison's classmate and lifetime friend, D. Hamilton Jackson, was the leader of a great labor struggle in 1916. So Harrison comes from these roots of class struggle. He knows these roots. He also knows of the African traditions. And when he writes later, he talks about the black people of the Virgin Islands are almost entirely of African extraction, and they can't fully be understood without similar reference to characteristics to be found in West African Negroes, from among whom the slaves of Danish islands were drawn, mainly the locale extending from Upper Gold Coast to the southeastern limits of Nigeria. He talks of traditions, African communal traditions, which are persistent. He elaborates on them. So he's rooted. He's aware of who he is and where he comes from. Now, his mother dies in 1900, unexpectedly. There's no indication. It was expected. I found no indication. But she dies in 1900. Actually, she dies in 1899. Forgive me. And he comes to New York in 1900. And when he comes to New York, he comes following the lead of an elder sister. And in my research, I found this very interesting, that oftentimes a lot of people coming from the Caribbean to the U.S., it was oftentimes a female who was the first, took the lead, you know, and then paved the way for others. This was the case in Harrison's family anyway. And he comes, and when he comes to New York, he's living in the area of West 62nd Street is where he stays at first. And now that is the area of densest concentration of African-American and Afro-Caribbean. So even from the beginning, he is rooted in poverty, but in the African and Afro-American community, Afro-Caribbean community. When he comes to New York, he tries right away to go to school, and he's able to get into high school at night, which, again, this was quite an accomplishment. There was no really real access to schooling, very little for African Americans, but he was able to get in to go at night. And he starts writing. First, let me just mention, when he arrives in 1900, what he encounters is it's right after the fourth great race riot in New York City history. They called it a race riot, but it was essentially whites attacking African Americans, Afro-Caribbeans. And it was said, Harper's Magazine said that a black person couldn't walk between 42nd Street and 59th Street without fear of being seized by a mob. When Harrison arrives that year, in 1900, at least 107 African Americans were lynched, including four at one time in Georgia. Harrison encountering lynching is utterly shocked, and that's one of the issues that he immediately starts writing about. Claude McKay writes similarly and explains what Harrison felt very well. Claude McKay from Jamaica writes, when he came to the U.S. a few years later, it was the first time I had ever come face to face with such manifest, implacable hatred of my race, and my feelings were indescribable. I had heard of prejudice in America, but never dreamed of it being so intensely bitter. And I think, you know, people to this day coming from elsewhere in the Caribbean, Africa, oftentimes react similarly. I mean, you know, it's just a shock, and it's overwhelming when they encounter what they do here in this country. So Harrison, beginning in 1903, when he's barely 20 years old, starts writing letters to the New York Times. And he has 14, he's in high school, right? And he has 14 letters published in the Times in that period. So he's searching for a way to express himself and address these issues. And he also gets involved around 1905 in important black intellectual working class circles. And these are down, he's still living in the West 60s area. The IRT subway doesn't get completed till 1904 when people start moving up to Harlem. But still in this period, great concentration in the area where Harrison lived. It's a five blocks area. It's considered the most densely populated area of New York and, quote, the meanest tenements. So on West 53rd Street in Manhattan, there were two churches, St. Benedict the Moor Roman Catholic Church and St. Mark's AME Church, right? And they would hold lyceums. And at St. Benedict's, there would be working class scholars. People don't realize working class scholars includes people like Arthur Schomburg, who was a clerk, John E. Bruce, who was a messenger, and they're active with St. Benedict's. And at St. Mark's was George Young, a Pullman porter, who kept a stall with 12,000 books on black history and literature on 135th Street. And Charles Burroughs, who was a postal worker with Harrison, and later founds the Kriegwa Players, and whose son founds the DuSable Museum in Chicago, and Williana Jones Burroughs, who's a teacher and a union activist, and later on an important radio host in the Soviet Union during World War II. And they're active, particularly Charles and George Young, they're active at St. Mark's, right? Now, at St. Benedict's, what Harrison writes is he calls St. Benedict's the intellectual center of Negro New York and the germ of black racial consciousness. And he explains, they would have these lyceum, they'd have meetings, they'd have speakers come every week. And he explains, the fiercest opposition in debate could not take from the cordiality of personal friendship. We learn to insist on the right to differ, to criticize, and to dissent from that which we believe to be wrong, and to do this openly and publicly without beating the devil around the stump. And that tradition stays with Harrison. That's that intellectual integrity he carries with him for the remainder of his life. In this period, he also starts getting involved at the White Rose Home for Ladies. It is it was set up by Victoria Earle Matthews, but the woman who's really running it is Frances Reynolds Kaiser, who's a social worker, first black woman to graduate from what became Hunter College. She was a close personal friend of Paul Lawrence Dunbar and later becomes an aide and principal assistant to Mary McLeod Bethune. But she's running this White Rose Home where black women coming to New York from down south, from the Caribbean, elsewhere, could come and have a safe place to stay. And if they had children, there would be kindergarten classes, you know, and even education classes for the adults. And Harrison, who had little money, would teach for free the kindergarten classes to the children and black history type classes to the adults. He, in this period, this is still his intellectual growth now, he starts a diary, which is a fascinating document. And when I first tracked down his family around 1981, I had been writing on him for a while, and his son and daughter were alive at that time. And they took me into an apartment on 150th Street in Manhattan after our third talk. And they said, here, take these papers and do what you need to do with them. And I was overwhelmed that they trusted me, had confidence in me. And I immediately preserved them, archived them. And subsequently, they've been placed at Columbia University. They're available. There's a finding aid online. The family got all the money. No ripoff by me. And the papers are there. But I was working with his papers for quite a long time, and it was not until 6 or 7 years later when his daughter and I went out for a dinner, and she reaches into her bag, and she was in her late 70s, I think, at the time. She reaches into her bag, and she goes, I have one more thing for you, Jeff, and she pulls out his diary. I had already written 800 pages on his life. I had no idea the diary existed, and it's a striking document because he's very straightforward in it. He puts forth what he thinks, what he encounters, his estimate of things at the time. He does it with a sense that, you know, when I'm going to write this as accurately as I can, I realize down the road some things that I think are important are going to recede in importance. Other things that I think are going to be less important will loom large. I'm not going to write this to make myself seem especially particularly good. And it's a very important document for understanding him and his life. And when he starts it, he offers a pledge to the mother race from an untamed, untamable African. He writes, poor, heart-sore, and soul-starved mother race, who shall minister to thy deep desires? Who shall bind up thy wounds? O Africa, when shall be the term of thy long degradation? Behold here, even now, I pledge thee, O my mother, that I shall devote my years to thee. And he goes on and he says, take my youth, my labors, my love, my life, my all, and do thou, when I shall have died for thee, take me to thy bosom, an untamed, untamable African. So he's kind of dedicating his life as an African descended person to African peoples. He's also
let's do this. We've come to the end of our program pretty much today, and you've done such a great job in giving this overview of this not so well known genius and an extraordinary person who brought us much closer to our shared, whether you come from the continent or you come from any part of the diaspora, he had the vision to use his skills to bring people to a common knowledge and appreciation of what it meant to be African. So what we will do is kind of leave it here for the moment, Jeff, and we come back tomorrow, and you will take us through the second half.
That sounds fine with me, if that's okay with you.
It's fantastic with me. I'm all about, we couldn't get this knowledge and information from a better source than you. I know the way you work. I know the countless hours, many of them sacrificial, that you invest in your work so that people all over the world could know things that haven't been told before, and so important and so central to our understanding of struggle, and also about the individuals who didn't see the world, you know, as an individual component of it, but much more as an agent catalyzing the information, the aggregate information we have of our shared condition. So I so appreciate the work that you have done and continue to do. And I know it has been extremely sacrificial on your part to do it, but it has never, ever discouraged you. And the fine work that you have done as a scholar, I mean, it's beyond reproach. So I thank you so much for being with us and getting us started today. And tell us a little bit, if you can, be running out of time, but give us a clue as to where you would want to go tomorrow.
Thank you. What I'd like to do tomorrow is I'm quickly moving from this to his starting to get involved. I'll offer some comments on his interactions with Booker T. Washington, with W.E.B. Du Bois and the NAACP, some of the things where he disagrees in the early years. Then I want to move into his Socialist Party years and talk about his work and its significance for today and for the left today. When he leaves the Socialist Party, what profound insights he offers. Then I'm going to talk about his founding of the Militant New Negro Movement and what he tries to do with that. Then I would like to talk, and it's very important, about the Liberty Congress during World War I, which he convenes with William Monroe Trotter and other black activists, which is the
The music is telling us it's time to say goodbye, and we will see each other again tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening, and of course there will be adequate time to accommodate your questions and comments and to react to what is being offered by Jeffrey Perry. So we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Ellington, you don't live around here. You moved away.